Hello and welcome to Railway Mania. This episode is all about the steam locomotive number 35011, General Steam Navigation. At the height of World War II, the Southern Railway introduced its first Pacific tender locos, the Merchant Navy class. The chief mechanical engineer behind these was Oliver Vaughan Snell Bullied. In 1937, Bullied had moved to the Southern from the LNER, where he had worked with Gresley, in developing leading designs such as the mighty P2 class and the record-breaking A4 class. Bullied was always seeking to push the envelope with locomotive development, and the three-cylinder Merchant Navy was packed full of features and innovations to enable more power, different maintenance regimes, and to lessen the effect the locos had on the permanent way. The Merchant Navy design was followed by the smaller Light Pacifics of the West Country and Battle of Britain classes, which mimicked the distinctive boxy air-smooth style. The locomotives were extremely powerful and capable of incredible performances, but drew criticism for several issues, notably fires which broke out within the air-smooth casing around the boiler, a tendency for high coal and water consumption, and the restricted visibility caused by the casing. In 1953, number 35020 was approaching Crewkerne Station when the crank axle, which is the centre driving axle that all three cylinders drive onto, fractured. Thankfully, there were no injuries, but the locos were withdrawn while redesigned crank axles were fitted. Between 1956 and 1960, British Railways extensively rebuilt all 30 members of the class, removing the distinctive casing and replacing the bullied chain-driven valve gear with three sets of independent Welshirts. A note on chain-driven valve gear, this doesn't mean that the wheels were literally driven by chains as on a Sentinel shunting loco, rather that the steam going into and out of the cylinders is controlled by the valve gear, and that valve gear was driven by what were effectively large bike chains being driven off the crank axle. 11 rebuilt Merchant Navies still exist today. 35011 General Steam Navigation is one of the preserved members, but the owning group has a rather different plan for it. Number 11 is going to have the rebuilding reversed and be returned to its as-built condition. Today I'm going to be talking to Andy, Graham and Steve from the General Steam Navigation Locomotive Restoration Society about what they've achieved so far and the plans for the locomotive. Guys, if you just want to go around the room and introduce yourselves.
I'm Steve Rapley. I'm the Chief Mechanical Engineer for the Society.
I'm Andy Collett. I'm a trustee of the Society and also chairman of the CIC, the owning group of General Steam Navigation.
I'm Graham Musprad, I'm a trustee and also a director of the General Steam Navigation CIC as well.
Before we jump into the history of the loco, there's something, I want to show my ignorance on something. And my mum said, don't make fun of people who pronounce things wrongly because it means that they've read it in a book. So is it bullied or bullied?
It's bullied.
It's definitely so, bullied. Okay, great. Yep. I haven't been pronouncing it wrong life.
Bullied used to say that his surname was pronounced bullied as in succeed. And Monsel was pronounced Monsel as in cancel.
I'd never heard that.
Straight in with a fact. I love it. I was wondering if you could give me a potted history of number 11 in service in the time ending with her withdrawal.
Yes, certainly. I mean, she entered traffic on the 30th December 1944, so under wartime conditions. The Bullied Merchant Navy Pacifics were actually officially classed as mixed traffic locomotives, partially due to enable them to get the order through the works under wartime conditions, but also they did have 6'2" driving wheels, so they could be classed as mixed traffic rather than necessarily express passenger locomotives. She was used out of Nine Elms on the West of England main line throughout most of her career. After the war, she got repainted from the wartime black livery into malachite green in sort of early 1947. And then finally, obviously, British Railways took over in 1948. And many of the express passenger locomotives under the initial British Railways liveries were painted in express passenger blue. But actually, number 11 was one of three Merchant Navy Pacifics not to get the express passenger blue livery. She went straight from malachite green into BR Brunswick green. Like a lot of the Merchant Navy Pacifics, all of them, she was eventually modified, rebuilt, as they call it. And this happened in 1959. That's when she lost the bullied chain-driven valve gear and lost the air-smooth casing to resemble a bit like a BR standard locomotive, like a Britannia. But she certainly kept some bullied features that were very novel to the locomotive. The free-steaming boiler, for example, was a classic bullied innovation with its steel firebox. Also kept the characteristic Bullyfirth brown cast wheels, unlike which were solid wheels rather than spoked. At that time, she gained outside valve gear, Wolschart's valve gear, and so on, in common with the rest of the members of the 30-strong class. She eventually was withdrawn in 1966. Just after withdrawal, she actually lost her centre crank axle. It was swapped with a plane axle from another locomotive to keep that locomotive running. Quite why this happened and why she was withdrawn, we're not quite certain at this time. She was one of the early withdrawals, and actually she'd only had a main service about 18 months to 2 years beforehand, so she was in relatively good condition.
So that's quite strange, isn't it? Because that's a case where British Railways said, well, even though this locomotive is relatively fresh out of being serviced, it's still worth removing the wheel set to keep another one in service.
Yes, and it's almost unique. I'm not aware of other locomotives where this particularly happened. But unfortunately, of course, it meant that she's ended up with a plain centre axle, so no crank on it. And this
so effectively was, a large push-along locomotive.
Yeah, very much so. And that's how she ended up at Barry. She would have been towed, like other locos, dead to Barry, but, with no centre crank axle. Now, from our perspective, this means that it's a major thing to replace the crank axle as part of the restoration. But actually, it does mean that because it's such a major thing, it gives us the opportunity to look at putting her back into that original condition prior to the rebuilding in 1959, which a locomotive owner probably wouldn't have done if it had its centre crank axle. So because we're doing all this major work, it makes sense to look at doing something that's unique in preservation.
Number 11 spent, was it 16 years in the open air at Woodham Scrapyard?
Yes, and then she was purchased from Barry and ended up at Willerton on the West Somerset Railway for a while. And here the centre crank or the centre axle was changed again. So we now have a plain axle and wheel sets from Braunton. But
so is that because in those early days of preservation, the engineering wasn't really there to retire locomotives easily, so it was easier to take one out of a scrap condition loco?
I thought Braunton's axle was flawed.
Actually, Steve's correct. I was going to say the same thing. There was some kind of defect in the actual axle.
Does that mean that same defect is on the locomotive now?
Well, within the axle, but we have to change the axle anyway for a new crank axle. So the fact that the axle is flawed doesn't really matter to us because it's a part we're not reusing. We're reusing the wheels and we're going to get those retired, but the axle itself is surplus to our requirements.
The flawed axle's already been pressed off of the wheels. The wheels are down at the South Devon Railway and the flawed axle's already been removed, so no longer an issue from our point of view.
Makes sense. So if we're thinking back to when this locomotive arrived in the West Somerset, it's been out in the open for 16 years. What kind of condition is it in at that point?
Well, she was, apart from the centre crank axle missing and no tender, she was fairly complete with the point with respect of the cab and all that sort of thing. So the main structure was all there. But a lot of that has since been quite badly corroded because after the West Somerset, she ended up at Sellenge in Kent on a private site there. And it was from Sellenge where the Locomotive Restoration Society was then able to purchase that locomotive. And we've subsequently moved it to the Swindon and Cricklade Railway, where we have the opportunity to put her under cover and we'll be able and actually work on her properly there rather than being in an open field.
Such a huge difference. Being able to work undercover, it's just, I mean, it's so miserable sometimes working outdoors when it's rainy and wet and you've got no power. It's just, it makes everything harder.
Very much so. And although we're not fully undercover yet, the building which she's currently residing in is sort of three quarters finished, but that will give us full cover. Yes.
Since the society acquired the loco, what work has been done?
Well, initially work was done at Sellenge to sort of preserve as much as we could. And so she was obviously given a good coat of paint to ensure that what was there was kept in as good a condition as possible. We knew that there were certain things that was going to be expendable, the smoke box and that sort of thing. So the smoke box was actually full of water because it wasn't covered, or the chimney wasn't covered. So there'd been quite a lot of corrosion in the smoke box.
Is there any danger to damage to the cylinders from water leaking down?
Potentially, and that's something we will have to look at. But they seem in reasonably good condition. In the middle cylinder actually is going to be replaced anyway as part of the returning it to original condition, because under rebuilding the middle cylinder block was changed. So we can't use, for example, a rebuilt Merchant Navy cylinder block or a rebuilt Light Pacific cylinder block in its place.
And we'll get into that in more detail shortly. Moving on to the actual restoration itself, I guess the biggest question that people might ask is, why for you is this project important? Why is it important for you to be able to replicate this locomotive in original condition?
It's not just a case of replicating, it's also a case of improving. In some ways, Bullied was ahead of his time with some of the innovations that he brought out. Some of them were successful, some not so, but these days, with the technology we have now and the computer-aided design, we have the potential to make it the locomotive it always should have been, if that makes sense.
It's also the missing link in preservation. You know, we have a number of rebuilt Merchant Navy Pacifics, such as Clan Line and Peninsula Oriental Line and so on, that are operational at the moment. But there isn't one in its original condition. Whereas with the Light Pacifics, because of the 110, not all of them were actually rebuilt. So a number of Light Pacifics exist in both forms.
And why was that? Was that because they rebuilt so many and then thought, well, we're going to get rid of them anyway, so why bother?
It was partially down to timing, and it was originally the plan to rebuild all 110. But I think as that process carried on, the modernisation plan was starting to be formed. So eventually they decided not to go ahead and rebuild the entire class.
And of the Bully Pacifics, the Merchant Navy is the first one that was introduced.
That's correct, yes. So the Merchant Navy
predates the West Country.
Yeah. So the Merchant Navy was first introduced in 1941. So the first batch of 10. We're number 11, which is the start first of the second batch produced in 1944. Then there was a final batch of 10 built in 1948. The first Light Pacific wasn't introduced until 1945, just after the war.
What are the facilities that you're working in at the moment? What kind of environment is the loco in, and how easy is it to work on currently?
At the moment, it's a developing site. The Swindon and Cricklade have their own fully equipped workshop along the line at Hayes Knoll, but they're developing the site that we have at Blunsdon, so that they're gathering together a machine shop where we'll help them finish building the shed, so we'll be completely undercover. Eventually, there'll be concrete floors, so we'll be able to have lifting jacks in all the equipment we require. So at the moment, it's a work in progress, but when we're finished, it'll be a fully fledged workshop.
And is that a case of having to gather together all the tools and equipment and machinery needed?
Absolutely. I mean, we have some of our own equipment, and the railway's kind enough to lend us the equipment they have. So between us, we have quite a reasonable range of equipment. As the restoration progresses, we will need more specialist equipment as we go along. So that will be a large part of our strategy, is to fully equip ourselves for the tasks ahead.
And some of the work that will be undertaken will also be undertaken off-site with other specialist contractors as well. That's an option that we will be using. So not all the work will be actually carried out at Blunsdon. But the Swindon and Cricklade Railway have given us an excellent base. We've got great cooperation between us and the railway. For example, when we had the crane in to do the boiler lift last October to remove the boiler from the frames, we were able to allow some of the time from our crane hire to lift a wagon off its axles on behalf of the Swindon and Cricklade Railway. So there's a lot of cooperation between us and the railway.
Well, it's good when you get on with your landlords, isn't it?
It does help.
Indeed.
So how big is the society? How many members are there currently?
There's currently around about 280 members of the society. So it's easy to join the society. It's only currently £12 a year. And for that, members get a newsletter, the packet, as we call it, three a year. And the chance to actually work on the locomotive as well. So,
well, how many people do get to work on the locomotive? That was going to be my next question. Is COVID aside, what kind of working parties are we looking at? So if anyone's looking at joining, how many people can be working on the locomotive at any one time?
There's no limit as such, obviously, at the moment, like you say, because of COVID, we're working under slightly reduced working parties to ensure social distancing. But hopefully with the government's announcement tonight, come April, we'll be able to restart the working parties properly. And we've got at least four new working members to add to our party. So that'll bring us up to around about 10 regular working members. But anybody else that wishes to join us is more than welcome. I also have the role of volunteer liaison officer. So if anyone that's listening is interested in joining our working parties, feel free to contact me at andrew.collett@35011gsn.co.uk. We'll be able to join you up to the society and welcome you into the fold.
We should be able to put a link in the description as well. Let's talk about the engineering side of things. I know that you've touched on this earlier, but one of my questions was, is there a risk of reintroducing problems from the original design? So what can be done now to mitigate those issues along the lines of what the P2 locomotive group is doing with the issues on their design, trying to address, you know, the pony truck design and the crank axle on theirs? What can be done to avoid repeating what you might say mistakes? Because, you know, BR obviously had their reasons for rebuilding them.
A lot of the potential mistakes obviously were ironed out in the design in the 18 years between introduction and when the rebuilding program occurred for our loco. There's a lot of commonality between the Merchant Navies and the Light Pacifics. And then obviously when the rebuilding program finished, there were, I think, something like 50 Light Pacifics not rebuilt. There's 10 of them that are still in existence, and I think 7 or 8 of those have been preserved and running. And they've shown that with modern materials, some of the issues with the, there are issues with train stretching and things. With modern materials, that's disappeared. There's this suggestion that the oil bath might have leaked, and that may have been down to materials and methods that were available at the time of construction. But with modern materials and different welding practices that are available now, things like oil bath leakage should be reduced, should disappear. Obviously, there's an issue with the Merchant Navies and with the Bully Pacifics in general, but certainly with the Merchant Navies, with the crank axle. And there was the failure in the early 50s at Crewkerne. That was addressed at the time, and the design was revised. And the crank axle was, on all the Merchant Navies, was changed either before rebuilding or in the rebuilding process to an improved balanced design, which is the one that we aim to try and to get manufactured for our loco. So I think all the major issues were ironed out. The rebuilding was just about reducing the cost of maintenance and serviceability. The raw mechanics of the loco, 90-odd% of the machinery, wasn't touched. Obviously, visually, they look different, but in terms of how it works, the boiler is the same. Two of the cylinders are the same. The running gear is essentially the same. It's just the valve gear and the crank axle.
Well, that leads me on really nicely, because this isn't really just a case of just bunging on some air smooth casing and just hoping no one notices. Like, a lot is being changed on this loco. So could you run me through what is on the replacement list?
Starting at the front, working back, as we mentioned previously, the middle cylinder is almost certainly has to be replaced. That there's very, we could think about different options, but the best option in terms of being able to grandfather the loco so we can run on the main line is replace the cylinder that's in there now with a new middle cylinder based on the original design.
Does this differ in design for the ones used in the West Country in the Battle of Britain class?
Yes,
it's bigger. It's possibly, you could say, it's less complicated, but it's certainly bigger because of the amount of power going through it. The Merchant Navy is a Class 8, it's a more powerful locomotive.
One of the questions that came in was, could you just borrow a central cylinder from one of the other Light Pacifics? But
you'd run into horrendous, you wouldn't be able to grandfather if you did that. You'd play up with the balance of the loco because you'd have a middle cylinder that was weaker than the other two, which would make the exhaust sound a bit strange. And you'd put undue stress on that middle cylinder.
Yeah, the porting arrangements on the middle cylinders for the Light Pacifics were different to the Merchant Navies, so you couldn't just bolt it in.
Did any survive from the original batch?
No, they're all removed in the rebuilding process and scrapped. So we have to manufacture from fresh. I know we can do things like, well, modern casting with polystyrene patterns and printed patterns. I think the Mid-Hans has done something similar with, I think, Swanage. And methods like that we can use that, again, modern techniques means the cost of doing this compared to what it would have been a decade ago, 20 years ago, it's gone down by an order of magnitude. It's going to be expensive, but it's probably going to be tens of thousands, not hundreds of thousands of pounds.
Well, cylinder manufacture was something in preservation once considered an impossibility, but it seems like as we've used up all the remaining life in all our locos, it seems like one of those things that's going to become more and more common anyway.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at other projects that recently producing brand new cylinders for big locos similar power to ours, it's something that can be done. the foundries exist. It's just, and the patterns, it's easier to make a pattern out of polystyrene and print it. It's then lighter for people to handle, and you get a better quality finish of the casting. So it's a more straightforward and faster process.
Okay, and then what's next on the list?
The smoke box, obviously, that on the original design was essentially a hexagon. It's a very strange shape. We need a new chimney. That the rebuilt chimney was a different shape. The outside of it looks the same, but the internal shape of it is different. The original is what's called a Lemaître, essentially a Lemaître blast pipe. It's a good design. It's quite a modern design of exhaust. It's further along the development chain than something like a Karlchap that you get on an A4 or even on the P2.
Are there any proposals to change the drafting arrangement, or are you going to stick with the original design?
We might.
Because I know that there was, when the A1 Steam Trust was first talking about Tornado, Livio Porter put together a load of recommendations for it, which I don't think were followed up on, but it certainly made for interesting reading.
It is. We're not going to go as far as Dante Porter's recommendations on the A1, because that was really just something that looked like an A1.
Yes, it was a Porter engine with an A1 body, yeah.
And obviously we've got starting from a blank sheet of paper, and we have most of the engine, so the scope for a massive change like that is beyond what we want to do, and it also run into issues with grandfathering again. But we have been doing some work with Loughborough University, looking at the aerodynamics both internally and externally of the loco, and looking at even small changes. We have looked at things like essentially a Lempore exhaust, which is a more modern design, looking at a Giesel, but also just with the basic Lemaître, that there's things that could be changed, quite subtle changes, like changing the angle of the nozzles, the steam nozzles, by half a degree, which is nothing, could have a significant performance improvement.
Well, this sounds like the kind of thing that the Duke of Gloucester Society went through when they effectively corrected the mistakes made by BR during the building of that loco, and they found that actually, if it had been built as designed, it would have been really good.
Yeah, I'm not going to say that the Merchant Navy was a bad design. They're fantastic. That some of the testing that was done in the 50s at the Rugby plant, then on the road, the performance of these locos, the potential performance, certainly before they were rebuilt, is just incredible. That they can pull 20 coaches behind them over the Settle and Carlisle at reasonable speeds. They're very, very powerful loco. All the tweaks we're looking at are things that would either improve the efficiency of the loco, so reducing coal consumption per mile, or alternatively increasing the power that the loco can produce. So you get a balance that if it's more efficient, we use less coal on the level sections, but being able to maintain speed, or certainly not slow down as much as you go up a bank.
Well, I certainly found that in my misguided youth when we were doing engine swaps on cars. And things like that, was that often you'd end up using less fuel with a more powerful engine because you weren't thrashing the hell out of it to get anywhere.
It's the same idea.
I mean, one of the things with the bullied boiler, which is to this day still one of the most free-steaming locomotive boilers out there, bullied on the original Merchant Navies did not fit dampers to the ash pan. So a fireman couldn't control the amount of air coming in through the ash pan into the fire.
Was that a cost-cutting exercise?
Bullied's view was, why would you want to stop a locomotive from producing steam? Whereas actually you need to be able to control it. And that's partly why they were rebuilt, was down to the fact that it was the economy of the locomotive. Because if you can't damp down the fire at various points in its operation, you will end up burning more coal. So the rebuilt Merchant Navies had dampers fitted to the ash pan to give greater control. I'm a big fan of Bullied, but that did seem to me to be an obvious omission on the Merchant Navies. Now, I'm not sure, and Steve will be able to probably say whether we're planning on maybe looking at some form of dampers. You know, it's not as if we are operating under the same, you know, permanent mainline running in service. We're under preservation. So, you know, the fact that it might be a little bit more expensive than Clanline to run on the mainline, for example, might not be an issue. But
after the exhaust system, is it the valve gear that has to be tackled next?
Yes.
Well, this is one of the biggest differences in the design, because
it is.
Is it the rebuilt had three sets of Wallshirts valve gear, whereas the original all ran off the chain driven?
It did. It was essentially a miniaturised Wallshirts, but instead of having the timing driven by individual throws off the central axle and quite significant rods linking the various parts of the valve gear, it was all miniaturized in the space above the leading axle, essentially, and then driven off chains.
What's the advantage of doing that?
You say, well, first of all, you save weight, that the rods are significant lumps of metal. So you reduce, there's a bit of hammer blow issue that you don't come into because you've got less reciprocating mass to balance off. The timing is better controlled because it's done off ratios of gears, essentially. So you should be able to maintain the performance of the valve gear through the sort of the life of the loco, and certainly the life between services. You don't get the drop off that you get on full-size locos.
Is that where you can more easily compensate for wear in the components and things like that?
In theory, yes.
And effectively, by encasing the valve gear inside the middle of the frames with an oil sump, it's more or less lending itself to be more like an internal combustion engine. You know, the car you've got parked in your drive has an oil sump, and pressurized oil is pushed around through the components, through oilways and so on. And that's what Bullied was trying to achieve here by reducing the amount of servicing, in theory, required, because you didn't have all the separate oiling points that you have on a conventional set of valve gear. It's encased in an oil bath and pressurized at 2 bar. So, you know, you're trying to achieve that internal combustion engine efficiency there.
Is that similar to what they were trying to achieve with the Caprotti valve gear later on? Or even earlier, actually, with the Lentz system?
There's still multiple oiling points with those sorts of valve gears, and what, you know, by encasing it into a sump, it's still trying to achieve some efficiencies. The fact that the sump did have a tendency to leak, certainly through the types of materials for seals and so on, you know, this reputation of them, of the oil sump leaking all over the place, I'm not quite sure is quite so warranted. Yes, some oil would have leaked down into the wheels and so, and that sort of thing.
I suppose in this area, the learned experience of the preserved light Pacifics can be used.
Indeed.
Your question about the similarity to Caprotti and Lentz, I mean, it in terms of what it does to the valve timing, it's a similar idea. I think that's what Bullard was going for, that it's about the issue with wall shirts is your valve timing over time becomes less precise, and that leads to inefficiencies in the system. And all the rotary kind of valve gears like Caprotti, like Lentz, and what Bullard went for were ways of maintaining your timing throughout your service intervals so that your loco is more consistent in its performance.
I mean, obviously the locomotive still wears its distinctive Bullard Firth Brown wheels. Were those modified during the rebuild?
Yes.
The only difference being is they had balance weights added to them, because as Steve mentioned, with the original chain-driven valve gear, you didn't have any reciprocating masses as such to have to counteract, whereas, of course, when they changed it to traditional wall shirts valve gear, they had to put some balancing weights to counteract the hammer blow.
Extra weights. Mm. There was some small weights on the crank axle. You can see on the inside of some of the pictures that there's a very small weight there, but it's only nowhere near the scale of the what was added on the rebuilds.
Is that a significant task to modify the wheels back to original condition?
The weights were welded onto the outside of the wheels, so in theory we can cut back that welding to remove those additional weights. They're effectively a large plate of metal welded to the wheels in the right place.
Plus the axle we got from Braunton, because it's a plain one, it's not a centre axle, and I think the leading or training axles on a light Pacific, I'm not too sure how much extra weight were put on them, if any.
Yeah, there's certainly some weights on the other wheel sets as well that will have to be taken off.
Okay, and then what's the next stages with remodifying, but it's demodifying? No, un-re-debuilding.
Technically, it is actually un-rebuilding in a way. You know, there's the usual question about what do we call the original Pacifics. You know, they are known as unrebuilts, and some people say, well, it can't be an unrebuilt if it's original because it wasn't, you know, but we are actually unrebuilding it technically.
It'll be the only
unrebuilt. Yes, indeed. I like to call it putting it back into original condition.
Well, what's the next stage with that? So huge task of manufacturing all the valve gear components from scratch.
We need to still remove the various bits of the rebuilt the wall shirts valve gear from inside the frames and outside the frames, because it's all generally in the wrong place. We then need to replace, I think, all of the frame stretchers, certainly the ones forwards of the crank axle, because they enclose and support parts of the valve gear. And the various brackets that were on there to support the valve gear were removed. Holes were cut in them where we don't want holes. It's going to be easier just to take them out and replace them. And we've got to take the frames apart anyway at some point to get to change the cylinder.
Well, that was going to be my next question, was can you do that in situ, or does that mean the whole thing has to come to pieces?
Well, I think you need to open up the front to get the middle cylinder out, and so it'll be the same process, whether we need to separate it entirely. I haven't looked at that yet, but we certainly, it needs to come apart a bit to get the cylinder out and to get the stretchers out and replace them. So it's we need to take this loco basically to pieces, not down to every single nut and bolt, but it does need taking apart a significant amount and then replace bits and put it back together.
I mean, it needs a new rear drag box, complete rear end to the locomotive as well. So, you know, those sorts of things, it's a major bit of reconstruction, but we need to ensure that the section of the frames that we're going to be splicing the rear drag box onto are solid and sound. So,
and you've already mentioned about modifying the ash pan. Are there any other changes that would need to be made to the design to bring it back to, well, an improved original condition?
It's a question of if there's a feature that was brought in under rebuilding that doesn't take away from the loco being an air smoothed chain driven valve gear Bullard Pacific, then we have to ask ourselves, why are we removing it? It may be that we run into the issue that if we want to take this loco on the main line, we need to consider grandfather rights. And I don't know, if we change the glass in the windows that from one spec to another, that's not going to change the grandfather ability. But if we change something in the mechanics of how the loco works, we could. So we've got to take a view there that where's the balance of cost, that is there an upfront cost that outweighs the lifetime cost of going for this setting or that? It's
there were some modifications made to the locomotive prior to rebuilding. So for example, when first introduced, the cab front, for example, was a flat fronted cab, very narrow visibility forwards out of the forward window of the cab. These were then modified to what's known as the wedge shape cab. Number 11 received that cab modification in September of 1950. That was done very much as a feature to improve visibility. So you could call that a safety feature, a safety benefit. So for us to put, for example, the original style cab back on, we may run into issues with mainline running in the sense that it's pushing grandfather rights too far, because it was modified to a wedge-shaped cab, which does mean that she won't be quite back into the original 1944 condition. But it does make a lot of sense from a point of view of, you know, we don't want to be detrimental to visibility. It was a change that she did carry in original form.
I think a lot of societies face this exact issue, is like, how much do you put up with or introduce issues that you know are going to be problems? So say, for example, if it's, you know, the replica of Planet, and it's got that crazy system of trying to reverse, put it into gear, everything else like that. Well, if you were to change that, it would change the fabric of the locomotive, so it wouldn't be right to do that. But if you look at something like Sir Hayden on the Tallaght-Glyn Railway, then they absolutely made the decision to make the locomotive easier to live with, because it was just a nightmare, like extending the cab, making it a nicer place to be, etc. So I guess every society has to go through this process of deciding what to change and why, and does it affect the society?
Yeah, and also it's a bit, like you say, it's a bit of a balancing act, because we're restoring yesterday's locomotive, but we have to make it compatible with today's railway. So we have an aim to get her back as close to original condition as possible, but there will inevitably, you know, have to be some compromises, like Graham says, along the lines of safety, etc.
Yeah, there's no point in it being in original condition if it can't go and earn money.
Or can't run on the main line or such, yes.
It can't run on the main line, essentially, yeah.
You know, another question we get asked sometimes is in 1954, for example, and this was common to all the Bullied Pacifics, their original boiler pressure, 280 PSI, which is one of the highest that was operating in the UK, was reduced down to 250. So again, that was done before she was rebuilt, and it would make sense for us to keep it at that 250 PSI. Again, that was done for measures to improve efficiency and so forth. Typical Bullied again, you know, he wanted to go for the highest, and, you know, his view was we want to create as much steam as possible and make it as powerful as possible. But it was sort of at the expense of some of the operational efficiencies. And again, that was what was the driver behind rebuilding at the end.
We've already touched on the crank axle a little bit, but would you be able to use one from another rebuilt merchant navy as a base?
Yes. It's a very simple answer. Yes, if we could find one, well, actually from a rebuilt Bullard Pacific, be it a merchant navy or a light Pacific, if it's rebuilt, it's the exact design we need. But unfortunately, there's not many that have not been restored. I think there's...
Well, you know, Winston Churchill's not going anywhere. I'm sure they won't mind. Swap it out. I'm sure no one will kick up any sort of stink about that.
Well, Winston Churchill probably wouldn't be suitable because I've been investigating this, and from what I can see, the light Pacifics that weren't rebuilt, they had some modification to the crank axle, but it wasn't put to the replacement design after the Crewkerne incident. And for a merchant navy, we really need the post-Crewkerne design.
Well, that means the National Railway Museum can rest easy then.
The one off Ellerman lines might...
I was about to say that. I keep eyeing that up every time I'm there.
They've got another one!
We would have to add the chain sprockets onto the crank axle as well. That's sort of the but they're a bolt-on addition, really, so...
Well, I'll have to do that anyway.
Are the chain sprockets, are they made as part of the axle, or are they in two parts clamping around the axle?
I think it's two parts that clamp on.
So, great. Okay, so you just need a crank axle somewhere, or to manufacture your own. So what's the process of that? I mean, obviously you're at the early stages where you're investigating feasibility. What have you found so far?
We're actually close to doing it. I think without the COVID restrictions, we would be further along. The aim was actually to try and get it done last year. I think it may happen this year. We know the design we want because obviously it's been around for 60, nearly 70 years now. The issue we have is around the correct type of steel to use. The question of grandfathering rights, we have to, ideally we would use exactly the same steel as was used in the 50s. The issue we have is it's only currently available in bits that are about the size of a wine bottle or slightly bigger. It's not big enough. And so we've got to try and either find an alternative that is available or find other people that need new crank axles. And we are in conversations with other groups about this, and hopefully in the coming months we will get some progress that...
But I think from your point of view as a society, I mean, it would be such a huge leap forward because it would really show everyone that you mean business. It's not just a pipe dream. It's not just, you know, something that would be nice. It's something that's actually going to move forward, because once you've got those large, almost capital expenses out of the way, and it's just a case of labour after that point. Well, not just, but you know, I mean, more fundraising and more labour.
Yeah, exactly.
Once we have the crank axle, we have a viable machine. We have a viable three-cylinder locomotive again. And until that happens, we've got lots of bits of metal that look like a steam locomotive, but they won't work in their current form. You can't run it as a two-cylinder loco, and so we have to have the crank axle. And once that happens...
It'll also be very symbolic, because for many years, General Steam Navigation was sort of a bit like the Duke-dubbed Project Impossible, simply because of having to manufacture the crank axle. So once that's done, it will really put us on the map and prove we're on the road to taking her back to... Steve.
Yeah, the material is fairly critical because, as Steve said, identifying the modern equivalent to the original grade of steel enables us to then follow on from grandfathers. But then you've got a source somewhere that can provide that grade of steel in the size and form that we need to create a crank axle. And unfortunately, that can't be done in the UK, so we're having to look elsewhere, whether that's Eastern Europe or South Africa or United States. And all those locations then bring in other issues into play. First of all, minimum order quantities might mean that the minimum order could be far greater than what we want and therefore push the price up. Or even the tariffs from different countries. And ironically, Brexit actually could do us a favour in that respect. If we went to the United States for the steel, post a deal with the USA rather than the European tariff scheme with the USA, it might bring the USA cost down to source material from there. So all these things are in the melting pot at the moment.
Literally.
Yeah.
So it's a bit of a cheeky one. I mean, this was this question was worded to me as, are you buying a fire engine? but what it really means is, are you worried about casing fires? So are these stories of the locomotives having fire within the casing? There's actually a famous photo of one of the merchant navies in blue, and you can see the distorted panels down the side of it from the results of a casing fire. Is this a concern?
Not really, although you're quite correct. It did happen when they were in service, because if you think they were in service 7 days a week running thousands of miles, so the oil from the motion did get thrown up into the lagging behind the casing and did occasionally catch fire. But for the way we'd be working GSNA with modern technology, we can hopefully cut down on the oil loss. But with regular cleaning, steam cleaning in between runs, it's only really when you get that build up, which we wouldn't allow to happen. So we don't foresee that being
an issue. a lot of the myth or misinformation surrounding the casing fires, people assume it's because of the oil leaking out of the oil bath as being the cause of those fires. Actually, if you look at the way the axle boxes are lubricated on a bullied Pacific, they were basically trays located in the cab and oil being fed to the axle boxes. And generally, when the locomotive was stationary, you would get more oil in the axle box than was actually needed. And a lot of that oil, when the locomotive then moves off, would actually then end up in the wheels, caught in the pockets of the bullied Firth Brown wheels, for example. The question is then, what would then ignite that oil? And a lot of the cause was put down to actually upon braking, the sparks generated by the brake blocks when the locomotive was braking from speed would actually then potentially ignite that oil that's excessively on the wheel set. So actually during their service life, the brake block material was changed to a material which produced less sparks in that case. And therefore that was a modification done in service to reduce the potential for those fires to take place. The first 10 Merchant Navy Pacifics actually had, underneath the cladding, a full set of splashers above the wheels, which prevented any oil or whatever from getting up onto the cladding. And as a weight-saving measure, the subsequent 20 didn't have those splashers in place. But they did then change the underside of the cladding internally on those to again provide protection from any oil splashing up. So they, whilst they didn't have full splashes, they had a catch-all component underneath the cladding to help prevent that. So the point really is that, you know, it's not necessarily the oil sump that was the cause of the problem. During their working life, that problem was partially resolved by the change of material of the brake blocks, the addition of a, call it a splasher if you like, underneath the cladding. And also, again, as Andy said, under preservation, you know, making sure the wheels are kept clean and more rigorously clean than they would have been maybe in service. You don't see that issue with the likes of Tangmere or the other light Pacifics that have been worked quite hard on the main line. Mm. So I don't see it as a problem going forwards. We can dispel those myths and, you know, the classic, oh, well, yes, it's a fire engine. Well, yeah.
But the tender was lost at Woodham Scrapyard. So what are the plans with regards to a tender, and what style will it be? Will it have the raves, or will it be cut down?
Well, obviously, we need to build one. We need a new one. We've discussed this. When she was built, she had a Series 2, which is, I think, 5,100-gallon tender. We may go for that. We may go for the similar to the third batch with the 6,000-gallon. We may look at reconfiguring the amount of coal and water for modern operation. But it will, from the outside, it will look like obviously a bullet tender, one of those two designs. It will, for most of its life, I assume it will have the raves. It might be, we may look at for if you're simulating towards the end of its condition in original condition without the raves, but having the raves gives us even more space envelope to put things in, like and things or compressors for air brakes, and or as I was saying, change the coal water ratio. So from the side you won't notice the difference, from the top you might. The appearance that we want to go for is the classic air smooth look, so it has to have the full rave.
Anyone who's been on the footplate or something like Tornado know that on a mainline loco, like, space is really at a premium. So I guess having that extra volume in the tender will help putting any sort of equipment in there.
Very much so.
Yeah, because also we'd have to bear in mind all the electronic gubbins we'd also need to run mainline. They'd also have to be accommodated in there. So it will be a very well-used space in whatever configuration we choose to have.
Yeah, I think my sort of what I envisage is a tender similar to what the Merchant Navy Locomotive Preservation Society have done with Clanline. So it's a 6,000-gallon tender. It'll have the air pump for the air braking built into that tender. It will have low-level connections for filling up with water, for example, from fire hoses. You know, my view would be to build it like that, but it would ideally, yes, it would want to have the raves. One of the issues why the raves were removed in the first place was to give better access for watering the tender and so on, and also not being a catching point for lumps of coal to be held up behind the raves. So one of those issues we would resolve by putting the low water filling points in, as a number of mainline tenders are now fitted.
So this is somewhere that like a fire hydrant can be plumbed in.
So
and water can be forced into the tender rather than have to drop it in.
Exactly. So it actually makes, when you're on the main line, it's safe to operate. You haven't got to work at height with a water hose. So if you ever go on a rail tour with Clanline, for example, it has effectively fire hydrant type connections at low levels on the back corner of the tender. So, you know, they've effectively got that tender design approved for mainline running. So if we were to copy that design, but with the addition of just some raves at the top, we then have an already certified design, but unique to us with the raves. I mean, interestingly, number 11 did actually run before rebuilding with a cut down type tender. She was fitted with that in 1957. We could, in theory, run with a cut down tender without the raves and still be prototypical to a condition she was in on the main line prior to rebuilding. Perhaps we would be able to come to a deal with Clanline at some stage to maybe borrow their tender for a run, even though our tender perhaps would be the full raves.
Is there a consensus then on the cab? Is the ideal to have the original style, but knowing that there might have to be that compromise in modifying it for better visibility?
I think in terms of the cab, the only way we can say we could have the original style cab is if we do something else to improve the exhaust clearance, because it was put in with the smoke deflectors to try and obviously clear exhaust, which is a problem with the bullet air smooth casing, and it was an improvement, but there's still times when you do get poor visibility. The only way that I can see from the Light Pacific design of getting the exhaust clearance improvement that we need to even think about going with the original cab is a different exhaust. That if you look at videos of City of Wells on the main line with the Giesel ejector, you do get significant exhaust clearance. Some of the simulations we've done of the Merchant Navy design with a Lempore ejector with the same smoke box draft, so operating in the same way as the existing design, you can in some respects halve the amount of smoke that's potentially billowing in front of the
cab. That was the main thing. That's what David Wardo was always talking about, is that you shouldn't have any smoke really if you're doing it properly, inverted commas, that drifting steam and smoke should become less of a problem if you just reduce the amount of smoke in the air.
Well, it's something about how much is going through and going out, but the issue we'd have with the loco, if we want to change the exhaust, is, from my perspective, yes, we could try and put in double or even triple Lempore ejectors and have this loco sort of a class 9 or class 10 Pacific, but it would look nothing like the original loco. I want to try and maintain the image of the loco, because that is what our shareholders and our donors are buying into and want us to restore. So to my mind, it has to be something with a single exhaust, and ideally a single round exhaust. But if you put in what would be effectively a short Lempore ejector, which is basically the existing one just stretched a bit, you do get a good improvement in exhaust clearance without impacting on the mechanical performance of the loco. So it may be something like that, where we could, if we could improve how the exhaust gets away from loco and demonstrate that we've got better than the original design, we could then say, well, let's run it with the original cab and see what happens. Maybe we don't go out on the main line the first time we do it, but if we can find somewhere to test it where we can run the loco at higher speeds, like the Great Central, for example. I know they ran Tornado in at sort of, I think, 70 odd miles an hour there, something like that. It's a enclosed environment. It's a test track, essentially. We can do it and we can video it and analyze it. It'd actually be very close to where the academic research has been going on in Loughborough. If we did it and it didn't look good, we could say, let's not do it. There's certainly this pictures, the images of this loco with the original cab, which would be nice to replicate if we can do it in a safe way.
Do you think there's any way that practical tests could be done in advance with an existing unrebuilt Light Pacific, or are the two just incomparable?
It's challenging because I mean, you could try it, But the challenge is you have to get it up to speed and you have to have it steaming at rates that are equivalent to the merchant navy. And then there's a balance of, it's not just you've got this amount of air coming out, how much steam and air is in the exhaust at the same time. It'd certainly give us food for thought, but then we'd also have to persuade the owner of a Light Pacific to change their exhaust and run the loco at 70 odd miles an hour. But we may also say to them, here's a way to make your loco performance improve dramatically, because it should, if you look at what happened with City of Wells, it should increase the performance of the loco at the same time. So it's a win for them and a win for us.
Well, and City of Wells is almost known for that Giesel ejector now.
Yeah, and the Giesel is not actually a good exhaust.
No, I think John Bate would agree with you.
It's good for clearance, and it is good in terms of getting more performance, but it's not well proportioned that you could get more from it, and you can certainly get a lot more from a Lempore if you had the tenacity to do it.
But even leaving the issues of smoke clearance aside, the original style cab, the front window was extremely narrow. Actually, the brake ejector valve is also located in front of that window inside the cab. So a driver is looking over the top of that, the brake control valve, through a very narrow window. And if you imagine sort of trying to drive a car with an immense blind spot, sort of from probably forward looking from almost 15 degrees through to almost 90 degrees.
You're trying to drive a car through a letterbox.
Yeah, you can understand why the cab was modified in the way that it was. And actually, when you look at it, to create the additional amount of wind forward-facing window space that they did by turning into a wedge-shaped cab was actually quite a nifty little trick, really, within the constraints of the loading gauge that we have.
And talking about driver visibility, so it is said that the original condition engines had issues with restricted driver visibility because of the casing. And obviously you're putting the casing back on. So is this a concern, and what can you do, possibly using modern technology, to assist with this?
Well, putting a modified wedge-shaped cab on assists to a certain extent. But also, when those cabs were first built, you know, things like AWS wasn't fitted to the locomotives, the advanced warning system for the signals and so forth. If we go out onto the main line, we will have to have those sorts of, you know, features on the locomotive. So, you know, things like being able to actually see the signals. In theory, a modern day driver in a diesel doesn't need to sit there and actually look at those signals, because the cab, all the information in the cab is telling them what's ahead. So, you know, from that perspective, it shouldn't really be an issue. You know, it's not as if Light Pacifics in original condition haven't been running on the main line anyway.
No, and Tangmere runs obviously with the air smooth casing on the main line without any issues. So,
well, one issue.
Well, maybe Wootton Bassett, but no, I wasn't going to mention that.
About the boiler, this is a huge stumbling block for so many societies. What condition is the boiler in? What do you know about the boiler? And are things like the longevity of the steel firebox a concern, or even the complexity of the design?
The boiler itself, we had the boiler lift, which was a huge milestone for us as a society, last October. So that was the first time the boiler had been off the frames in 61 years.
That's crazy, because that is so much longer than the locomotive was actually in use for.
Exactly. And when you look at the internal condition of the firebox, you know, we've now removed all the boiler tubes, and there's a few hundred of those of various diameters, and most of them are 18 foot long, so they're quite weighty. But actually, she undertook a major overhaul in 1965, a year or so before she was withdrawn. It was quite frustrating in a way to be removing boiler tubes out of the boiler, which were actually really good condition, very little corrosion. Obviously, she's been sat outside now for a long time. And as I mentioned earlier, the smoke box in particular had been, you know, certainly at some stage full of water. So the front tube plate is showing signs of delamination to a certain extent. And we've now got the boiler off the frames with all the tubes out. The next stage will be to actually have that properly inspected and see what it is that we've got there. She's actually got a boiler which would have originally been on one of the first 10. She's got a North British built boiler. To my eyes, it looks in reasonably good condition, apart from potentially the front tube plate.
The inner firebox itself looks in incredibly good condition, yeah, as well as the thermic siphons. So that bodes well, but as Graham says, we wait to get professionally assessed and see what occurs.
Is the damage to the front tube plate due to the water ingress in the smoke box area?
It is, yeah.
Yeah, because what happened when she was at Barry, another group wanted her superheater element. And because she was a scrap locomotive, instead of removing it carefully, all they did was cut the center section out of the roof of the smoke box and craned it out. And of course, then it was open to the elements, which basically created a fish pond in the base of the smoke box. So like Graham says, the top two-thirds of the tube plate is in frustratingly good condition, but the bottom third is suffered badly from being submerged.
It is repairable. Changing a front tube plate is something which, you know, isn't beyond, you know, certainly current capabilities when you look at the restoration work that's been done and obviously the new builds as well. So it's not an impossible task by any form.
We have to plan for replacement and hope for repair. But there is a balance that in repairing it, what cost are we going to incur it down the line? Because it is a weak point and it will need servicing.
Well, this is really kind of what I was asking about with regards to components like having a steel firebox, because, you know, it could be a major expense now, or it could be a major expense when you have to replace it 10 years down the line, but hopefully the cost is offset slightly by then.
Yeah, although a copper firebox is more expensive to produce than a steel firebox these days with the price difference in materials. The thermal expansion, you know, of a copper firebox is different to a steel firebox. You know, yes, with any preserved locomotive, you're going to have long-term costs of replacements and so on. You would factor that in. You know, Clanline's now, she's had more boiler tickets in preservation than she did in service now, probably. You know, yes, a number of Bully Pacifics are having various parts of fireboxes and so forth either replaced or patched. And that's the same with any type of locomotive, really.
From an engineering point of view, is there anything that we haven't touched upon that you think will be coming up that will be either a challenge to solve or something that's on the cards anyway?
There's an interesting one. There's the trailing truck, which we're fundraising for at the moment, that GSN has what for a merchant navy is unique. It's got a fabricated trailing truck instead of a cast one. It's much lighter than the others.
Why has it got a fabricated one when all the other locos have got cast ones?
Well, it's a case of all the other locomotives in preservation have got the original cast ones. So the first two batches, so the first 20 merchant navies, had a cast design of trailing truck. The last batch of 10 had a fabricated version. It was partially the same materials and also weight. All these things are interchangeable. So during the career of a lot of locomotives, these were swapped around. Mm. So Clanline, for example, originally had a fabricated trailing truck when she was introduced. However, by the time it came to withdrawal and then subsequently preservation, she'd been fitted with a cast trailing truck off of another merchant navy. So she, in theory, is running around with a trailing truck that she wasn't introduced with. And likewise with number 11, she's received the trailing truck. Originally, she would have had a cast trailing truck, but subsequently was fitted with a fabricated one. And that's the one she's got in with since she was withdrawn.
What kind of challenges there ahead? So you're saying you've just launched the fundraising for that. Then what's to do with the train truck?
There's some areas which have a bit of wastage, shall we say. They've rusted. And it's the beauty of the fact that it's fabricated. It needs taking apart to a certain extent. And the poor bits of metal need cutting out and replacements welded back in. But that's an easier process with a fabricated thing than a purely cast truck, because, as I say, you can take it apart and you don't, by welding in new bits of metal, you're not putting in the thermal stress through the entire truck. It's just in one section. It's not a massively challenging task, but it's a key one to our project, because it's the first big piece of the machine that we're going to restore and repair and show that we are moving forwards with returning this locomotive to original condition. And as I say, it's something that's unique. It's similar to the ones on the Light Pacific. Being a merchant navy, it's about a foot longer and it's unique to our machine.
I think a lot of groups sometimes can run into issues where there are just so many jobs to do. Everybody wants to do a bit on every job. What kind of roadmap do you have in terms of this, then that, then that?
We have a full engineering plan from about 6 months ago, leading forwards the full kind of chain of how do we go from at that time a loco with a boiler with most of the tubes missing, and no, obviously no tender. How do we go from that to a fully restored, re-engineered bullet merchant Navy Pacific? And what tasks do we need to do at the same time, sort of parallelizing things so that we're not waiting for this thing to be finished so we can then bolt it on so that everything is done in conjunction with each other, so that really the challenge, the thing that's going to hold up the restoration process is not in my field in the engineering, it's, sorry, Graham, it's in the fundraising. we want to be in the position where the thing that's delaying us, as it were, is the funds, so that as soon as we have the money to do the job and the right job at the right time, we do it so that we get this loco restored. But we need to be conscious that we don't want to get something restored too early, because otherwise it's going to be potentially sitting in Blunston.
Yeah, so that, like, there's no point in having a brand new drag box if there's no middle cylinder.
Correct.
Yeah, and also things like, yes, we've taken the boiler off the locomotive and the boiler's now sat there separate, but everything you do with a boiler is effectively time-stamped. So, you know, we don't actually need to work on the boiler immediately now that we've taken it off. Yes, we will make sure that it's in a form that we can get a boiler inspector in to inspect and tell us in their view what actually is going to be needed to be done to it. But there's no point in getting the boiler fully restored and certified and the 10-year ticket start ticking on the time bomb of that, if you like, if the rest of the locomotive isn't ready to receive that boiler.
Well, especially if you throw in like complications that a lot of people are facing now, where there's some sort of unexpected delay. So I mean, at my local railway, they had the 10-year certificate stamped on one of the locos back end of 2019, obviously with a view to getting it into operation in 2020. And obviously that all went out of the window because of, you know, the unforeseen circumstances of the pandemic. And I'm not saying that's going to necessarily impact GSN because it's going to be so much further down the line, but there's always something to trip you up at the last
minute. Yeah, that's always the case. I mean, I do feel sorry for some of the operators, like Clanline, for example, you know, where she hasn't been out on the main line earning money for a year. And she's not going to get an extension of the boiler ticket for a year to make up for that. She's lost that year of income. Obviously, that doesn't affect us in that sense, but it does mean that our engineering plan needs to be timed to maximise that boiler certificate. So having lifted the boiler off, whilst we had the crane there, we were able to lift the frames and take out the trailing truck, which makes it a nice single little item which can be worked on externally by, it will go to a specialist contractor to overhaul not just the frame components of the trailing truck itself, but the rolling bearings, the journals and the axles and so on will all get refurbished. You know, yes, they'll be refurbished, they'll be protected suitably with suitable protection and paintwork to ensure that they are kept in a good condition, ready for when the boiler ultimately can be rejoined to the frames and so on. But, you know, the middle cylinder has to come really before we put the boiler back on, so all these things have to be planned in advance. But
almost the bottom end has to be in a ready state for when the boiler comes back.
And you know, the trailing truck is something where we're trying a slightly different avenue for fundraising. We're doing it as what we call a fund group or a fund club, where instead of just donating to us, you become one of 30 members of the trailing truck club, if you like, who can purchase a lot of that trailing truck for £500. And we were looking for 30 people for that to raise what we think is the amount of money needed to refurbish that truck totally. They'll get some benefits. They'll have a little plaque on the trailing truck somewhere with their name on it. And there's some other benefits of being able to visit the loco and see progress and that sort of thing. We're looking at that. We launched that sort of fund group just at the start of the year. So we're still pushing hard and publicising that at the moment. There'll be a bit in some of the print media coming up. So press release has gone out. So these things all take a time from gestation to actually get out into the public domain.
There's a long road ahead. At what point do you need to get to before you can see light at the end of the tunnel?
From my point of view, I'd say that'd be when we achieve a rolling chassis, the chain-driven valve gears constructed, the new centre cylinders in place. Do you agree with that, Steve?
Yes.
Yeah, very much so.
Then we have the machine. We don't have the energy source because we need to get the boiler sorted, but we have the machinery, we have the locomotive.
I think when you look at the progress that the society has made in a fairly short period of time being at Blunsdon, for example, it's been less than 2 years that we've been at Blunsdon. There was no point in the Sellinge location in a big field to really strip it back, because what do you do with all the parts if you're just in the middle of a field? Whereas now we've been at Blunsdon, we've been able to get enough of the components off the locomotive to get the boiler out, which is the first major milestone for us. we've actually ticked off a second boiler milestone, if you like, with the fact that we've removed all the tubes. So it is now just an empty boiler waiting for a boiler inspector to look at. As Andy says, I think the next stage now is really looking at those frames. The trailing truck is part of that. A rolling chassis with a middle cylinder and the valve gear in place will be, I think, the real major milestone, because from then on everything's being put back onto the locomotive. We're still at a stage of stripping it down, and that appears to be almost a negative thing, because all we're doing is taking stuff off. Actually, when we start putting stuff back on again, it becomes more of a project. But I think from, you know, a publicity point of view, the boiler lift was a big boon for us. You know, it was no longer just a loco that's been sat outside for a long period of time. Yes, now it looks even less impressive than it did do, because we've got the boiler on one side of the car park and we've got the frames on the other side and a trailing truck sort of separated from it. So it is a bag of bits at the moment, but ultimately, when people start to see things being put back on, I think that'll be a major step forward.
Absolutely. What you said about facilities and working in open fields and things like that is that, I mean, preservation is full of stories of people without the facilities taking something to the bits and it actually being a detriment to the machine. So things degrade because there's nothing covering them up anymore, for example, or things go missing, or someone takes it home to work on it because there's no facilities and it never comes back, or someone nicks it. It's full of that kind of thing. So without the right facilities, there's almost no point in starting.
No, agreed. And the Swindon and Cricklade Railway have already been very, very good to us. I think we've got a very mutual arrangement, and we are there to help each other in that sense. You know, we are very careful about what we take off the locomotive and where we store it, and keeping records of that, you know, and photographs and so on, because there's a lot of bits that you think, well, where the hell did that come from? But we've made sure that we catalogue those components.
Especially with volunteer working parties where the person putting it back on might not be the same person who took it off.
Indeed. Mm-hmm.
That's right. So everything that comes off is labelled. So like you say, in 5 or 10 years down the line, people can look at a part and know exactly what it is.
Yeah, just saving time on thinking, is this brake hanger a left-handed brake hanger or a right-handed brake hanger, you know, and this sort of thing. Well, we've labelled it, so hopefully it should be fairly obvious when it comes to, you know, cleaning that up and putting it back on.
Yeah, check the reference before you start hammering it.
Yep. And I think a lot of people looking at the project from the outside, who aren't necessarily members at the moment, perhaps don't appreciate the amount of work that's going on behind the scenes. So yes, we've achieved the boiler lift and so on, and that's a very visual thing in last October, you know, working under the restrictions of COVID. You know, we would have been a little bit further ahead. You know, we were hoping to do that boiler lift before the summer last year. You know, Steve and the engineering subcommittee team that he's built, with the assistance of both Loughborough University and the University of Birmingham, giving us access to those sort of modern techniques, I think has helped immensely. And, you know, we're starting to create the full CAD drawing set for the frames, so that when we actually get to a point, we can look at the frames and the CAD drawings and make sure that what we've actually got matches, and where it doesn't match, we can make adjustments and so on. So a lot of that work in translating the original bully drawings and turning them into usable CADs for us is going on in the background.
Well, that's a really interesting question, because you're creating a CAD file, which is often made for something which doesn't exist, in order to build it. So it might seem quite strange to people as to why are you drawing them in these 3D programs when you already have them to hand.
Well, there's two reasons that, yes, we have the drawings to hand, but in order to manufacture new parts, some of the quality of these images now is rather poor. So we need to, if we want to go to a firm to say we want this frame stretcher built from scratch, from metal, they can't use the drawings we have. And with modern manufacturing techniques like CNC machining, if we produce new CAD, you can feed that into the machine. It also gives us the ability to try and avoid the problems that some other loco groups have encountered, where you take the drawings of the loco as is, you go off and manufacture it, you put the bits together and they don't fit together because there was a subtle error in the original drawings that would have been captured in the machine shop and a note put down, or they just made 10 of the locos and they all fitted. We could run into the same problem. In fact, we could run into a worse problem, because we have the issue that the frames that we're working with were made from the original drawings. If there's any errors in terms of how bits went together, it's in there. But we can use the CAD to try and see, do things fit together, try and measure the frames and see that certainly the bits that we're putting in should be in the right place. We're also, in conjunction with the University of Birmingham, we're doing finite element analysis on the crank axle and on the internal motion of the locomotive as part of our efforts to understand what steel to use in the manufacture of the crank axle.
May I ask, what is finite? Sorry, what was it called?
Finite element analysis. It's a way of doing numerical modelling of what solid materials do when they're working. So when you heat them up, when you apply load on them, how they bend, how they react to loads. It's what goes on inside the metal as the wheel is rotating, as the force of the piston, especially at starting, how the force of the piston goes into the crank axle and starts the loco moving. And there's a lot of stress there because you've got to overcome the inertia of the loco, and that actually bends the crank axle. It's a very small amount, but it does bend, or it should be a very small amount, and you need to analyze and check.
Well, I guess that if it didn't bend,
it would snap. So it's got to bend to a certain extent, but it can't bend too much because otherwise it'll break again, or not be in the right place. So yes, working with a student and a professor from the University of Birmingham doing analysis of the design so that we can say, well, if we can't source the original steel, if we put this steel in, whatever this alternative steel is, it will meet the design requirements.
So that's two universities that are actually involved in this project.
Yes,
already.
Yes. Yeah. Birmingham has quite specialism in railway engineering and technology. That's where we went to them. And then Loughborough, with the external aerodynamics, they have a lot of capability in that field. They work with Rolls-Royce. That's how I know them, because I used to work for Rolls-Royce and did one of these projects with Rolls-Royce. But it's a way of also engaging bright young minds, which makes me feel old now. But it's a way of engaging the next generation of engineers, giving them interesting projects to look at, because the way a steam locomotive works, it might, on the face of it, feel like old technology because it's a machine that's 70 odd years old, but the problems that you encounter in it are exactly the same that you encounter in modern machinery, in jet engines, in Formula One cars. We're using exactly the same technology that Rolls-Royce uses, that Formula One teams use, that across the mechanical engineering world and civil engineering world, basically all engineering at some point uses these tools, these type of tools, to look at problems and solve them in the virtual world. So putting something effectively in a wind tunnel, or seeing how the machine works before you build it, and we're doing the same thing.
Part of the aims of this, of the society as well, is yes, we're restoring a steam locomotive, but actually we also want to educate and inform people and so on. So the tie-in with the universities is sort of part of that in a way. As Steve said, it's giving those students the opportunity to work on something that's a real life project. You know, they can actually come down and see the work that they've done put into practice in the locomotive itself.
Well, there'll be a tangible result.
Yes.
It's not just all theoretical.
No, that's right. Yeah. You know, a couple of those students have now joined the society and hope to get even more hands-on when COVID, etc. allows. So I think, you know, it's ticking a number of boxes, but it's giving us access to that latest technology and design thought that perhaps other locomotive groups wouldn't necessarily have access to. So it helps us and we're helping them.
Fantastic. So moving on to the more general questions, I've got the most important ones at the beginning and I'll just group these together. So what livery will she appear in once restored? What colour will it be? What livery are you going to paint it in? What colour paint have you bought? What is a livery? What is your livery? Why aren't you going to paint it in my favourite livery?
It's going to be an interesting discussion, because you could probably ask me, you could ask Steve, you'd ask Graham which livery we'd like to see her in, and we'd probably each give you a different answer. Which is probably going to be the same for most of our shareholders. So I think the fairest way to do it when the time comes is to canvass our shareholders, because they're the ones who've invested in the locomotive, you know, see what comes back tops. On a personal note, and this is only me saying this, I'd like to see her in three different liveries during her running time. I'd like to see her in Southern Malachite Green, in BR Brunswick Green, and possibly slightly controversially, because she never actually ran in it, blue, which I think would look quite stunning.
I think they look incredible. I don't know if you're going to be asked from many people to paint it in blue with red lining. Very short-lived, but not too popular.
Very short-lived, and never actually ran outside of the works in that livery. Yeah, I mean, I think there's There, in theory, is a choice of five liveries, and Andy's picked up on four of them, one of which theoretically isn't prototypical, but actually I think she would look good in blue at some stage. You know, the boiler ticket lasts us for 10 years, effectively. When you look at some of the other locomotives, Flying Scotsman, for example, ran for a while in black, and certainly British India Line did the same thing on the main line, running in black. So she was introduced in wartime black. So there is a potential for saying, well, we'll paint her black to start with and run her for the running in period. And then BR Brunswick is always going to be, I think, the most popular. Personally, I'm a malachite man, so I can't wait to see her in malachite.
I know, I've seen your model collection, Greg.
And she did actually run in malachite with wedge-shaped cab as well. So that still fits even with the revised cab layout. Technically, in black, she would have had the original cab. But as Andy says, it will be down to the shareholders. But I think we can certainly throw out a first boiler ticket. There's no reason why she can't appear in a couple of liveries. Certainly things like Tornado have done the same thing. And changing the livery, you know, part of the way through the boiler ticket actually then recreates another field of interest for people.
What do you have in terms of resource, information resource available to you as a society? What survived? Because I know a lot of groups maybe struggle because there's no paperwork or documentation or diagrams and things like that. What do you have?
We have access to a collection of drawings that are, they're owned by the National Railway Museum, but the Bullard Pacific Locomotive Association has copyright on them, and they're drawings, they're almost all of the drawings that were done of the Bullard Pacifics and some other, there's bits of the Q1 and other locos in there, and those describe 98%, 99% of the design. There's the odd drawing here and there that's missing, generally of nothing too big, but it means that we have drawings of everything we need, almost. I mean, for example, with the crank axle, we have the drawing of the original design of crank axle. We have the design of the revised crank axle.
Which is the one you want, isn't it?
Yeah.
You don't want the original one, really. You want the
no.
good one. Yeah.
The only bit we're missing is the chain driver that went on the crank axle. That's not there. We have the design of the original one, but not the revision. And we have designs of all the changes that were done around smoke deflection over the years, that things that were implemented, things that weren't even implemented, things that were just in wind tunnel tests, that vast range of resource. And then we have the fact that obviously there's another 29 Bullard Pacifics out there that share a lot of common components with our machine, so we can go and have a look at them, physically see what is on their machine and what are we trying to copy, and that can be very helpful when not just looking at a piece of paper but looking at a lump of metal and see how these bits of metal go together and work, and understanding the design so that when we're trying to recreate it, we understand it's not just lines on a paper, it's 4 tons of crank axle.
And those theoretical tests and practical test results that you've got to hand will presumably be a huge time saver for you when you're trying to make modifications to the machine.
Yes.
Because you'll know what's been tried already.
Yes. Most of the modifications to the design that we would bring in, they would come under the bracket of tried and tested. That the only thing that we're thinking of that's slightly outside the envelope would be changes to the exhaust, but everything else, it'll be something that was either implemented by BR on the light Pacifics before the end of steam in the south, or things that have been done on preserved locos since, especially ones that have gone on the main line because of obviously grandfather ability.
So grandfather rights, the concept of grandfather rights. So this is whether you'll be able to run on the main line and the certification that goes with that, because a lot of people are going to be asking, is it going to run on the main line? Is that the intention? And I'm guessing it's yes.
Yes.
It's a large locomotive to be restricted to 25 miles an hour otherwise.
Yep.
Yeah, she was built to haul express passenger trains on the main line. Anything else would be a bit like a captive cheetah, you know, in a cage. We want to show her full potential. I mean, there is the danger in 10 years' time or whatever, the main line might not be open to us, but then we'd still have the opportunity of running her at speed on the Great Central. So we're going to do her to the utmost engineering specification, to main line specification, and yes, hopefully that will transpire.
So that means then, for certification purposes, you have to be able to prove that the locomotive in that form has run previously.
The thing with mainlining and certification is, I mean, it's not just paperwork, but the difference in terms of how we restore the loco is subtle. whether we go for mainline condition or not, because the pressure vessel is a pressure vessel. It still needs to meet those standards. And the issues with if the crank axle were to flex, that happens at very low speed. So all the mechanical problems that you need to get the certification for mainline running could be experienced in preserved condition. The question of grandfathering is essentially, if you've got this, obviously most of the loco, all the loco we have at the moment has run on the main line for 22 years. It's where we replace bits. And if we replace bits to exactly the original design with the same material, we have grandfather rights. It's the issue is there is basically minimizing the amount of components where that doesn't apply. Ideally, it'd be zero. I think, with unfortunately, with the crank axle, if we want to get that done in the next year or two, some aspects of it may not be completely grandfathered because of material choice. But it's that you want to mechanically replicate what has been on the main line before, so that there's no question that it's new. But then you run into the issue that if you look at a completely new locomotive like Tornado or Cock of the North or Hengist, they have almost the freedom that the entire loco is new. Even if they can say they're grandfathering it, it's a completely new machine. They need to analyze everything, but in doing that, they can improve anything they like. They can use whatever metal they'd like at the increased cost that brings in. But we're trying to strike the balance that we have the original machine, we're trying to recreate the original machine and not change anything just for the sake of changing it. It's because all that does is takes away from the authenticity and brings an increased cost.
And I mean, as Andy said, you know, we don't know what mainline running is going to be available in 10 years, 15 years or whatever. But it's not as if there are two standards. There's a mainline certificated standard, but there isn't a second standard underneath that for preserved lines.
So one is almost a stepping stone to another in a way, because you have to achieve a certain amount of certification just to run anyway.
Yeah. So we're by going at this stage and saying, yes, we are aiming for full mainline certification and making sure that everything is right and proper to do so, means that we effectively are achieving the best. You know, we're not going to cut corners on an area, whether it's a material grade or whatever, and not meet mainline standards. But then who knows that even preserved lines in the future may have to have all their locomotives to an equivalent standard. So we would be quite foolhardy at this stage not to work with an ambition to achieve those mainline standards and certification.
And then moving forward, what are you currently fundraising for? How, if people want to get involved, how can they contribute to the project, and where does the money go when they pay up?
So first of all, we're a society. You can be a member of that society for £12 a year. It's not a huge amount of money, and it's not our biggest income in that sense, because you know some of your membership money goes towards printing of the publication, the packet, or three times a year. We also offer shares in the locomotive. So there is the Locomotive Restoration Society, and we also have a community interest company. And you can buy shares in the CIC company and become a shareholder in the locomotive. Now, it's not like buying shares in a company that you're going to trade, but you know, we get a large amount of income from those shareholders. You get certainly some benefits of being a shareholder, depending on the number of shares that you purchase. But in addition to that, obviously, we have to raise funds for some fairly major components and costs. So at the moment, as I mentioned earlier, we've got the trailing truck, and we have also got a fund available for people to donate into for the frames and the motion. And we'll probably be setting up a further campaign and fund for the boiler and the tender in due course. So rather than just allow people to donate into a big pot, if you like, what we're trying to do is we're trying to break it down into different campaigns and run a campaign for a period of time, like the Trailing Truck Club. And then once that's funded, we'll move on and open up another form of campaign.
I think that really helps as well when you have transparency with your members and with potential members about, you know, what they're paying for. It really helps that people don't feel like, you know, it's just going to get like lost in the ether when they donate.
Yeah, I mean, every little helps. And obviously, like a lot of locomotive restoration funding, we've got the shareholders, and, you know, everybody is, you know, we certainly encourage more and more shareholders as possible. But yes, we don't have that one big pot, but every little does help. So, you know, whether it's someone putting 25 quid in towards sponsoring a gauge glass or whatever that might be. So we offer sponsorship on components. People can buy valve handles or whatever that might be. And then they can say, actually, yes, I'm responsible for the money that raised that particular part of the loco.
That's the great feeling, is it? You want to be able to go on the footplate and go, that's mine.
Yep. You know, and I'm a shareholder in another merchant navy as well. So it's nice to know that at least a bit of my money has gone towards the fact that is now running. So you've got that return, but you know, major shareholders will get their name on the loco somewhere and a plate in the cab or whatever, as will the trailing truck members. There'll be a plate somewhere put on the trailing truck with their names on. Yes, they might be the only people that know it's there, but they know it's there, you know. And they can say they've been part of restoring this. And you know, it is a unique selling point, the fact that it's returning it to its original condition. And like all restoration projects, why people put money to one project and not another is down to them. You know, there's people out there that like to put money into a new build but wouldn't put money into restoring another loco. We're sort of sat in the middle to a certain extent. We are creating something unique but also restoring a loco at the same time.
And where should people go to if they, for example, listening to this podcast and they want to find out more or they want to join?
Well, we launched last year. It was a job I did in the first shutdown, actually, was to revamp our website to 35011gsn.co.uk. So the website's been very much expanded with a lot of information on there, both historical information, data about the locomotive, anecdotal information about the locomotive in service. But in there as well, you can see our fun club. You can find out how to be a shareholder, how to join the society. And there's lots of information on there. There's further information about the university projects that Steve was talking about earlier. So we've tried to create a wealth of information. There's her full service record, for example, is also on the website for those people that want to find out exactly what happened when with the locomotive. So we're trying to build up a bank of information there on the website as a resource. There's things for some kids to do as well as part of the educational side of it as well. You know, if you want to know how a steam locomotive works, we've got an animated graphic on the website that will show people how it works. There's two versions of that. There's one for our younger generations and one for us oldies. But also information about, you know, why is the trailing truck so unique? Well, the trailing truck actually has its own page. You know, what was special about the bullied boilers? Well, that has its own page on the website as well. There's lots of bedtime reading there, but also a way to find out more about what we're doing and how you can join in and be part of it.
When I was looking through earlier, there was a great diagram of the chain-driven valve gear, which just helped me to understand what the difference is between that and conventional Walshirts or Stevenson, anything else like that. It's a really good information resource.
Yeah, and that's, you know, it's part of the uniqueness of the project. So, you know, I felt we had to be able to explain why it was different, why it's unique and what's special about it. So, yes, there's a section on how a steam locomotive works, which is common across nearly every other steam locomotive. But there's certain areas, the boiler, the trailing truck, the valve gear and so on, which we've tried to explain more. And it's certainly a site that we intend to develop further on that side. It's much about education as fundraising. There's still a few things I want to add, things like the brake gear on the locomotive was also unique, being the class brake system on the Bully Pacifics. Eventually there'll be a page on the website explaining how that works and why it's different. But most importantly, there's lots of information on that website about how you can join us and be part of the project.
Marvellous. Dare I ask, what date is the target to have the restoration completed?
If you've got a piece of string there, it kind of comes down to, like Stephen Graham have alluded to, the engineering sort of can progress as fast as the finance allows. I mean, we'd like to think we could get it done 10 to 12 years, but if there's a fairy godmother out there with a big chunk of money come along, we could get it done sooner than that. So it's a slightly open question, but I think realistically we'd be looking at around 10 years.
So if we come back in 9 years' time, and then hopefully we can record you putting the first fire in.
I hope we can come back sooner than that, because, you know, there's certainly other things that we're going to be doing with the locomotive in the meantime before we actually get a fired and full of steam. You know, there's, you know, maybe with the rolling chassis or something like that, when we can come back and talk about what we've done and how we've achieved it.
Yeah, I think it'd be great. I think people would love to hear about the progress that's been made since this episode that's going out.
Well, I think Andy's right. You know, 10, 12 years is, you know, in preservation terms, that's still an ambitious target. When you look at 35006, for example, beautifully restored. I'm a shareholder in her, and you know, that was a 30-year restoration project, and you know, and all they've done is restored her to rebuilt condition. But you know, I've done an extremely high class restoration on her. So I think we have set ourselves a challenging target, really. Yes, we actually can benefit from the restoration that the likes of the 35006 Society have done. And the one thing about bullied locomotives is the cooperation between the different societies and owners of bullied locomotives, whether that's Clan Line or whether that's gaining assistance from the guys with the P&O Line number 6. We do talk to each other. We do help each other. There's a sharing of resources and patterns and components and this sort of thing. And that goes on all the time amongst the bullied owners. And that's certainly, I think, a benefit. And we can learn from each other.
I've only been chief mechanical engineer for this project for, what, about 5 months, 6 months now. But the sharing of information with the other Bullet Pacific owners has been very helpful and excellent. The amount of knowledge that's out there, some of which they haven't any use for, especially the details of an original Merchant Navy Pacific, but it's just sitting there and we're able to tap into it. But then further knowledge of what's been done with the Light Pacifics, especially the original ones, and how can we pull on that knowledge to get our locomotive working and get around any of the issues that were still possibly niggling away in the background in the late 50s that were resolved under BR or resolved in preservation.
Okay, well, thank you all so much for coming on the podcast.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure.
And, well, hopefully we'll check in again soon and catch up with progress.
Excellent. Look forward to it.
Yeah.
Yes, definitely.
I hope you've enjoyed this episode of Railway Mania. If you want to stay up to date with General Steam Navigation, check out their website at 35011gsn.co.uk. Next time, I am going to be talking to Phil Parker of Garden Rail Magazine about getting back into the great outdoors, so look forward to that episode soon. Thanks for listening.